This is Jim Fester, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. Having concluded my conversation with Sophia, I'm going to discuss a variety of issues related mostly to domestic politics, but some 9/11 research and the 9/11 community. I think Sophia was exactly right when she suggested that there's too much infighting. It seems to go on in really rather vicious, if petty, ways, some of which have been extremely distressing to me as a philosopher, particularly a philosopher of science, someone who has studied the history of science and the philosophy of science and understands that science is our most reliable method for determining what is the truth, but that it must be applied in the appropriate systematic fashion, that it requires basing our reasoning on all of the available evidence. That's known technically as the requirement of total evidence. And where violations of that requirement are known as special pleading, the only side evidence favorable to your side, also known as the method of selection and elimination. Select the evidence that supports your side and eliminate the rest. We well know this in political context because it's the method that George Bush and Dick Cheney have systematically used to bias the case for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which had completely independent motivation. Really, they had to do with oil Israel and ideology, the idea of creating an American empire, but they knew that none of those motives were saleable to the American people. So as Paul Wolfowitz blurted out in a moment of excessive candor, they settled on weapons of mass destruction as the most marketable way to induce the American people to support these ill-conceived missions, which are, of course, turning out to be interminable and vast squandering of resources and deaths of thousands and thousands of Americans, but tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, even millions of Iraqis, and where we don't even keep count. But they're human beings just as much as we are, and they have a far more ancient civilization that stretches back over 5,000 years. But in our ignorance of history, we tend to disregard the fact that other countries may have had far more ancient legacies and made vastly more contributions to the world civilization than has the United States of America, which is a relative newcomer at around 250 years of its endurance. It's, to me, completely stunning how these things happen. But in scientific reasoning, you see, this is the sort of thing that defense attorneys and editorial writers frequently, and politicians, of course, do, is to offer only the evidence that favors their side. Thus, the Downing Street memo revealed that Bush had already decided to invade Iraq. In fact, we know from Paul O'Neill, the first Secretary of Treasury, that at the very first cabinet meeting, Bush was already talking about attacking Iraq, and this was long before the events of 9/11. So it's all been, fixing the, having the objective and then fixing the intelligence around it. It's disgusting and goes on to this day, as I'm going to explain. But the fact of the matter is, if we're trying to figure out what happened on 9/11, we got to consider the full range of hypotheses. I mean, theoretically, you even want to consider whether there could have been natural causes that were responsible for the events of 9/11 in New York, the destruction of the World Trade Center, hurricanes, typhoons, cyclones, what have you, tornadoes. I mean, it's obvious they aren't among the causes because the probability of the effects, which were so selective in taking out roughly all and only buildings with WTC designation, is not the kind of outcome that we would expect from any natural cause. It would be far more varied in its effects and less focused and systematic. But this just shows that what you have to do when you adapt the hypotheses to the evidence is consider what is the probability of the effects that we actually observe if the hypothesis were true. On the hypothesis that it was, say, a tornado, that brought about these effects, and we expect kind of a tornado-like meandering path of destruction through the city, just as we see in little towns and villages and cities in the Midwest when they're struck with tornadoes, not the very selective devastation that took place where the Twin Towers, for example, are turned into dust from the top down and disappear at about the speed of a free fall, and yet there's nothing left when it's all said and done. There's no stack of pancakes. There's just millions of cubic yards of very fine dust and millions of pieces of paper. I'm going to return to that. Millions of pieces of paper. I mean, there were just tons, literally tons of paper distributed throughout the city. And that seems to me to be an awfully important piece of evidence that some on one side of this debate are unable to account for. Okay, if we go beyond, of course, then we have the official government account of 19 Islamic fundamentalists hijacking four aircraft, flying the planes into the buildings, the jet fuel-based fires, and we know everything wrong with that. We know most of the jet fuel burned up in the first 10 or 15 seconds, that we had roughly ordinary office fires. We have 236 samples of steel studied by NIST, which determined that 233 had not been exposed to temperatures above 500 degrees Fahrenheit, whereas the melting point of steel is closer to 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit. We know that the other three samples hadn't been exposed to temperatures above 1,200 degrees Fahrenheit. So the whole official government story is a non-starter. In fact, there's no reason to even think that there was serious damage to the core columns from the planes, assuming they're real and not some kind of illusion. I mean, even if we take the official government account at face value, it's an incoherent account because its features contradict laws of physics and of engineering. The fires didn't burn long enough or hot enough to cause the steel to weaken, much less melt. We know from Underwriters Laboratory they certified the steel to 2,000 degrees for 3 to 4 hours at 2,000 degrees without enduring any ill effects. Well, these fires burned only about an hour in the south tower, an hour and a half in the north at much more modest temperatures. Even if you had all the jet fuel in the world, by the way, it wouldn't burn any hotter just by virtue of its quantity. So that there's a, you know, psychological tricks are being played all the time. Elementary fallacies are being committed to try to induce us to believe that because there was so much jet fuel, therefore it must have, you know, burned hotter than jet fuel can burn. But that's not the way it works. In fact, under ideal conditions, you could have jet fuel burn as hot as 1,800 degrees when it's fed pure oxygen, but that's still 1,000 degrees away from the melting point of steel. And it didn't happen long enough. I mean, you know, the steel is a very good conductor, so even if you heat up a part of it, that heat is transferred throughout the entire structure. So basically, you'd have to be heating up massive quantities of these 500,000-ton buildings, and it just didn't happen. So the whole government count is easily refuted. Okay, then what does that leave us with? Presumably various categories of controlled demolition. In other words, this was done deliberately. It was a deliberate demolition. But don't let the language induce you to suppose, therefore, it had to be, say, a classic controlled demolition of the kind that we observe at Building 7. Building 7, we see the explosions going from the bottom up, blowing out certain key support columns. The whole building comes down together, all the floors moving together. When it's all said and done, we have a stack of pancakes five floors high. This is not what happened to the Twin Towers, as we all know. Stand by.
Hello, Ted Anderson. Listeners of the network are familiar with the Federal Reserve note and understand the risks of deficit spending. Therefore, with catastrophic events, it comes as no surprise that some banks have currently placed limits on the amount of cash depositors can remove from their accounts. A fractional reserve system means only a small portion of your deposit is held in reserve for immediate withdrawal. Deficit spending will skyrocket through FDIC if the government is forced to insure deposits during a bank run followed by a depressed economy. A current effort is underway by the Fed, along with other central banks, to increase liquidity for depositors. However, an increase in money supply without equal expansion in productivity can cause inflation. In order to achieve strength and stability, I recommend a conservative portion of all investments to be calmly repositioned into gold and silver. While paper investments currently have been driven by debt, Gold on its own has held value for over 6,000 years. For more information, call 1-800-686-2237. That's 1-800-686-2237.
Imagine walking down the street and hearing footsteps behind you. They get closer and closer, and suddenly you have a sense something bad is going to happen. What are you going to do to defend yourself? Tebow Tech specializes in non-lethal self-defense products for you and your family. With everything from stun guns and tasers to personal alarms and pepper spray, Tebow Tech will arm you with the most advanced non-lethal products anywhere on the net. Not sure where to start? The Tebow Tech Essentials package is great for you or to share with your family. It comes with a 950,000-volt cell phone stun gun, a multi-pack of pepper sprays, an extremely loud personal alarm, and a how-to book for defending yourself with pepper spray, all at a low price. With these or any of Tebow Tech's products, you have the tools to defend yourself against an attack and get yourself to safety. Don't be a victim. Be a victor. Stock up now. TebowTech.com. That's TebowTech.com.
Would you like to know how you can use water as fuel and laugh at the rising price of gas? Then keep listening for a very special offer. GasFreedom.info has the information you need to learn about a simple technology you can have right now. GasFreedom is a do-it-yourself, affordable, practical, free energy device. It uses electricity from your car's battery to separate water into a gas called HHO. HHO, also called ground gas, burns efficiently and provides the energy your car needs. In just 10 minutes, you'll discover exactly how this is possible. This is the secret the oil and auto industry doesn't want you to know. Go to gasfreedom.info to learn how easy it is to extract energy from water to run your car.
During the month of August,
visit gasfreedom.info and receive $100 off of your order. Turn any car into a hybrid and laugh all the way to the bank. Visit gasfreedom.info. That's gasfreedom.info. Or call 239-628-3708. That's 239-628-3708. Call today.
Hey everybody, if you're anything like me, I'll bet you like to eat. I like egg scrambles for breakfast, fresh homemade bread, delicious pastas like lasagna, I love beef stroganoff, I love chicken noodle soup, I love desserts, all kinds of entrees and soups and desserts and breakfasts. I love that stuff. Now, food prices are skyrocketing just like gasoline prices. I mean, the gasoline prices have gone insanely high, probably going to go higher. Grocery prices are right on their heels. How are people going to be able to afford to eat? Well, I found a way to buy really incredible foods like I just described at half the price of last year's grocery bill. For less than half of what you spent for the same amount of food last year, I can have it delivered to your door. Let me tell you how. Go to eFoodsDirect.com right now. eFoodsDirect.com or call the toll-free number 800-409-5633, 800-409-5633. Cut those food costs now.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. Remember to let her into your heart. Then you can start to make it better.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. The first hour featured my special guest, Sophia. Today I'm talking about issues related to 9/11 research in the community and then some domestic political issues during the second hour. I was just mentioning Building 7 came down in a classic controlled demolition. The explosions began at the bottom, taking out key support columns. That's why you have that little peak there, a little ways in at the top, because that key support column has been taken out, so the building will tend to fall inward onto itself rather than outward into its own footprint or foundation, about the speed of free fall. All the floors are moving at the same time. When it's done, you got a stack of pancakes, okay, about five floors high. That's just what you'd expect from a classic controlled demolition. Now, that was a 47-story building. If you look at the World Trade Center, they're more than twice as tall. So if you had, like, five floors, and I think it should be like something like 12.5% to 14% of the height should be preserved, say 12%. Then you should have, you know, about 14 floors maybe for each of them. And that's not true. In fact, I had Father Frank Morales on the show and he explained to me they were actually reduced to pits below ground level. But let's call it ground level. There were no pancakes. Jesse Ventura was there 2 days later. He said no pancakes. He's made some of these points really simply. He said how three buildings with two planes, no pancakes, and how his propane stove burns hotter than kerosene. And it doesn't melt when he turns it on. But, of course, if the government's account were true, that would have to happen. So we see the absurdity of it. Now, if there's a fundamental flaw in Orthodox 9/11 research dating from David Ray Griffin even, it's the assumption that Building 7 and the Twin Towers were destroyed in the same way. That's manifestly not the case. And anyone who can honestly look at the footage of the Twin Towers being destroyed, turned into very fine dust, from the top down, all the floors patiently waiting their turn to be blown to kingdom come, in Morgan Reynolds' memorable phrase, okay, knows these are two completely different methods of demolition. They can still be called controlled demolition because it's the controlled or deliberate destruction of these structures, but they're done in completely different ways. As I say, Building 7, classic controlled demolition. Buildings 1 and 2, completely different. And therefore, I argue this is some kind of unconventional controlled demolition. It required some kind of weaponry that went beyond what was used on Building 7. If they used dynamite or RDX or thermite or thermite in Building 7, then they may have used some of that in Buildings 1 and 2, but that can't be the whole story because the effects are completely different. And here's something I want to put to those who think that they can explain all this with conventional explosives. Conventional explosives create great fire and heat and would burn paper. And yet we've got tons of paper all over the city. If those buildings were destroyed using controlled demolition, a classic controlled demolition with explosives of the kind that Stephen Jones, Kevin Ryan, that whole gang wants to insist was the case, then how is it, how can it happen that we have tons of paper that was not destroyed? You got all this very fine dust and tons of paper. It's everywhere. I've been looking at some photographs lately, just exhibit how much there was. It was massive. So if you got a mode of demolition that primarily involves intense heat and fire, it's going to burn all that paper. It's not going to be selective. So I say something is completely wrong with Orthodox research in 9/11 that insists that Building 7 and 1 and 2 were brought down the same way when they manifestly were not. And the idea that it could have been a classic controlled demolition on 1 and 2 is, when you look at the evidence, frankly absurd. It's so grossly wrong, I can't believe anyone continues to take it seriously. And how can you account for the fact that there is no stack of pancakes, that the buildings are turned into millions of cubic yards of dust, and the paper survives? Plus, of course, the other fault I lodge against Orthodox research is the claim of flowing molten metal, supposedly from the little waterfall from the 80th floor. Well, that's ridiculous. If that's supposed to be from thermite or thermate, then since it was used throughout the whole building, by hypothesis, you should have those little waterfalls all over the place. They should be randomly distributed all over these 110-story buildings. There's one location. Just happens to be a location coincidental with a Fuji Bank building having this battery of batteries there, a whole array of batteries there as a backup energy source in case the computers went out so they could guard the information for all their clients. So there's something peculiar about that location that led to that little waterfall, if it's even authentic, because I have photographs, some short coming out of the third division of windows and some the fourth. But it's manifestly nothing of great significance. It's certainly, in my opinion, no evidence of thermite or thermate because it would have to be everywhere. If it's really thermite, thermate, it should be distributed randomly throughout these structures. Is no one thinking about this? Is no one thinking about this? So if you're going to artificially constrain the range of hypotheses to explain this, cut out nukes, mini nukes, third generation, fourth generation, even if you don't know that they got, you know, many different kinds that have been affected for demolition purposes as long ago as the Eisenhower administration. They had nuclear weapons that were designed for the purpose of demolition. Suppose we could rule those out. You get a claim on that basis. It had to be conventional using RDX and thermite and thermate. This is absurd. The properties, the effects, the gross effects aren't remotely consistent with that hypothesis. So we've got to consider, if we want to figure out the truth, how it was done. Now, there's another group, of course, championed by Judy Wood, who has been promoting the research that suggests it was some kind of directed energy weapon. Now, Judy is so tentative about how it was actually done, that's about as far as she goes in describing it. I, for specificity, add that it could have been lasers, masers, maybe plasmoids. Something very sophisticated was going on here. If there was some way to use HARP, Judy is now suggesting the source of energy. This is my interpretation of her, what she is talking about, that there was a hurricane off the coast of New York that was never reported to the American people on 9/11. This is bizarre. A hurricane could theoretically be used as a source of energy that might have been expended in the demolition of the Twin Towers if you could figure out how to transform it in the constructive, directed fashion. Well, I think that's a fascinating hypothesis, but you, most of you out there have never even heard it before. Why? Because 9/11 blogger, for example, kicked me off its site just when I had a blog there. I mean, it's a blogger, right? You're supposed to have blogs. I had a blog there, and I was raising questions about Steve Jones' research and why I think focusing on this little tiny sample of dust is ridiculous. We don't know exactly where it came from. We don't know exactly its source. We don't know when it arrived in that apartment. I mean, they try to make these absurd arguments. I mean, you need hundreds of samples of dust from all different altitudes, locations. Steve Jones hasn't done that. I'll never forget the American Scholars Conference, how he holds up this little teeny tiny, says, this is enough. Well, it isn't enough. And I've explained why it isn't enough in a lot of different places, but no one wants to listen. If you arbitrarily can track the range of hypotheses, you may never discover the truth. So that what blogger and the other, you know, imposers of the orthodoxy, and, you know, their names are familiar, are really doing a disservice to truth. If you care about truth about 9/11, you've got to abandon this commitment to orthodoxy, especially when it's demonstrably indefensible. Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Evolution, well, you know, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out?
This is Tim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest the first hour was Sophia. This hour I'm talking a bit about the 9/11 research community, what goes on inside in domestic politics, and I just want to say a few more words about 9/11 before I turn to what's going on here politically in the United States. I think there's a way to cope with this, which is try to share information, evidence. Judy's very patient and painstaking about exploring evidence in a massive photo gallery she has amassed over time that is utterly fascinating. It's all beautifully documented. When she gave a presentation of several hours at the conference on the science and politics of 9/11 here in Madison last August. And I want to encourage everyone out there listening to me to go to 911scholars.org and order, say, just one copy of that DVD. It's $20 for 14 hours of some of the best research presentations you'll ever see, and send it to somebody who needs to look at this stuff, because there are too many closed minds out there who aren't coming to grips with the evidence. You have simply to look at the evidence to understand these orthodoxies I'm addressing are really indefensible. And that means those out there who are enforcing orthodoxy, and they range from, say, people like Reprehensor and John Gould at Blogger and Arabesque. and descend to persons who are vicious and cutthroat, like Colonel Jenny Sparks and Victronix. Those of you who are active in the community know of whom I speak. Undertake this subversive act of sharing information, evidence, because there's wonderful stuff in 14 hours for only $20. Let me encourage you to do that. If you know somebody who needs to know more about 9/11, believe me, this is a perfect place to go, because it's more advanced in terms of the presentations made than you will find from any other source. I love Sophia's 9/11 DVD, 9/11 Mysteries, but you need this to bring yourself current with the state of research today. It even includes a woman with a PhD in theoretical physics who, at the end of the conference, when I invited participants to offer their opinions, explained how, after seeing Judy's work, she realized something she hadn't realized before, that this appeared to her had to have been done using masers. Listen to her explain it. Think about it. Being closed-minded is unscientific, it's authoritarian, and it actually promotes the perps. It helps the bad guys here, because until we figure out how this was actually done, the more we run ourselves up blind alleys and ignore relevant evidence, the less likely we are to discover the truth. And if we don't discover the truth, we certainly are going to be handicapped in pursuing justice. So that's my invitation. That's my suggestion. I hope you'll pursue it. It would also be a tremendous benefit to scholars, because scholars has no funds, no budget, no income, other than from, you know, items like this. So you'll be helping to promote additional research in 9/11 and also spreading the truth, information, evidence relevant to determining the truth. So what's going on politically? Well, a lot of oddities. Last week, Ed Schultz, of all people, was promoting Hillary to be Barack's vice presidential candidate. This is, in my opinion, absurd on its face for all kinds of reasons. I tried to call in to say that I now get it. The Ed Schultz theory of change is that you begin with Bush as president, and then Clinton as president, Bush as president, and then Clinton as vice president. I mean, how could Barack Obama represent a new broom sweeping clean, a new way, change in Washington, if you bring back Hillary and all of her baggage? And that includes Bill and Monica and Whitewater and Vince Foster, and don't think the Republicans aren't salivating over the idea. So I couldn't believe that Ed Schultz was even offering that opinion, but he was doing so with great enthusiasm. Okay. So it looks as though Hillary, who's going to be speaking on the second day, clearly won't be the choice, and she shouldn't be. I believe the best possible choice for Obama would be Bill Richardson. He needs somebody who represents a very progressive approach, somebody who is very much aligned with him. Richardson represents a great deal of experience with diplomacy, with administration, with Washington. He's the guy who negotiated the settlement with the North Koreans. He's a brilliant guy, and he represents Hispanics. Great choice. So I'm reading an article now here in the Wisconsin State Journal for Monday, and it says McCain gains ground on Obama, and it says that now they're running neck and neck, dead even. And I say to myself, well, what's wrong with this picture? Okay, we know that everyone hates Bush. We know that everyone wants change. We know 65% of the American people think this country is headed in the wrong direction. Now, on the one hand, we have this young, a brilliant, articulate candidate as a representative of change. On the other hand, we have this old, senile, incoherent representative of the status quo. And you're going to tell me that they're running neck and neck, especially after Obama goes to Europe with a stunning triumphal visit to the Middle East and to Europe and to Berlin. Fantastic, wonderful, sensational. It wasn't that long ago, if you think back upon it, that Obama was running a 15-point lead, and that was before he made his visits to the Middle East. If there were honest polling today, I would project that Obama would be leading by something like 57-32. So what is going on? In my opinion, there's a deliberate skewing of the polls, which can be easily done. For example, just by excluding everyone who uses cell phones, right? Cell phones are expensive for pollers to contact, so they'll just do it without exclude the cell phone users, who are, I would conjecture, overwhelmingly favorable to Obama, and ask very leading questions to artificially suppress the vote so it looks as though it's very close. This has multiple benefits. One is that, you know, it reduces or tempers enthusiasm by the Obama maniacs, right? It makes it look as though Obama's doing something wrong, and therefore you get the internal criticism inside the campaign trying to figure out what they should do right, and they may make stupid mistakes like modifying Obama's position on offshore drilling, for example, when these companies already have tons and tons, thousands of leases they're not using, and offshore drilling isn't going to help Americans with their oil prices at all. All that oil goes on the international market. So that you have McCain just lying to the American people, saying it's going to help our oil prices next year. That's absurd. Wouldn't make any difference for 10 years, and then it only indirectly because that oil goes on the international market. It doesn't come into the United States, even if it's drilled out of the United States and its continental shelf. So McCain's just lying through his teeth, and he's become a pathetic caricature of a straight-talking anything. This guy is a disgusting cretin of the status quo. And in the third place, then, of course, it can set up the theft of the election using electronic voting machines, which has been the plan all along. If it looks like the election is very close, you see, because we've been induced into that by this constant bombardment by polls that are actually inaccurate, grossly inaccurate, if I am right, then they can steal the election using electronic voting machines, and it won't be very conspicuous. Now, I'm going to have an expert on voting and polling on the program on Thursday, Bob Fitrakis. And Bob knows a great deal about what's going on here, and I want you to tune in and listen because I think you're going to be dismayed. Now, there are other stupid things going on here, including I recently got an email from the LaRouche organization. I've been open-minded about LaRouche. I've had a number of members of that group appear on this program in the past. And here I get one entitled, Washington Sources Confirm That Barack Obama Is Clinically Insane. I couldn't believe this. I could not believe this. Absolutely stunning stuff. We'll be right back. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo.
Alabama state code makes it illegal to drive barefoot. In Downey, California, it's illegal to wash your car in the street. In Minnesota, you can be fined for displaying that your vehicle is for sale. These laws are obviously not made to protect us, but instead to help states profit. The use of red light cameras is another great example. They intrude on your privacy, are unconstitutional, and cost you valuable time and money. SprayYourPlate.com is a spray-on photo blocker that protects against red light cameras, toll cameras, and speed cameras. One application lasts a lifetime, is undetectable, and each can covers up to 4 license plates. Simply spray it on, let it dry, and you're protected. All orders are kept strictly confidential, and for the month of August, receive free shipping and a $5 bill enclosed with every order. Call 1-800-276-9601. That's 1-800-276-9601. Or go to SprayYourPlate.com. That's SprayYourPlate.com. Don't give your money to the state. Spray your plate.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. I think we all need help because there's so many lies being dished out these days. I mean, this thing from the LaRouche organization is only the most egregious. Listen to this. High-level sources in and around Washington, D.C. have confirmed the story implied by articles appearing in today's Washington Post and New York Times that putative Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama is clinically insane. Quote, Barack Obama has gone from being the presumptive nominee, now he's becoming the presumptuous nominee. Dana Milbank wrote in a scathing piece in the Washington Post that ridicules Obama's arrogance, megalomania, and paranoia. He traveled in a bubble more insulating than the actual president's traffic that was shut down for him. His schedule for the day announced Monday night he'd have would have made Dick Cheney envious. 11 a.m. en route to be announced, 12.05 p.m. en route to be announced, 1.45 en route to be announced, 12.255 en route to be announced, 5.20 en route to be announced. This article pointedly notes Obama's biggest challenge may not be Republican John McCain, but his own hubris. Should be noted, the alleged hubris Milbank refused who is not Obama's own, but that of the puppet makers who have deployed him. See, this is not even a coherent further claiming, oh, there's something wrong with Obama, but now it's his handlers. This is absurd. Obama needs to keep his schedule private because he's a candidate for assassination. I was asked a long time ago, what's the prospect of him being assassinated? I said 10%, and it increases as he gets more and more successful. I rated over 50%. They've got to keep his schedule tight. The Secret Service, it was already this funny business with a plane that was borrowed from the Hillary campaign. And he's got to have somebody who would be good and wonderful and strong to pursue his policies if anything happened to him. It would be a huge blunder if Obama chooses one of these meaningless non-entities out of a concern not to do any damage. This guy is all too likely to succeed him. Then we got a similar thing from Maureen Dowd of the New York Times, who says, you know, about Obama's hubris. This is all completely ridiculous. Maureen Dowd should know better. Dana Milbeck I've seen many times on Keith Olbermann's, and now I used to think he was a good guy, and now I despise him. This is all rubbish. This is completely incompetent. Anyone who's familiar with human beings, with men, I spent 4 years at Princeton, all male, 4 years in the Marine Corps, overwhelmingly male. I've had thousands and thousands of students over 35 years of teaching logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning. There is absolutely nothing wrong with Barack Obama's state of mental health, in my opinion. He is perfectly normal, rational, competent. He's brilliant. And if he says something like, you know, he doesn't want to fly too close to the sun, that's a classic literary illusion. That you shouldn't, you know, become too infatuated with yourself. That displays humility. And to suggest he's clinically insane, that's a medical judgment. That requires a clinical psychologist or a psychiatrist. Dana Milbeck and Maureen Dowd, to the best of my knowledge, are not psychologists, clinical psychologists or psychiatrists. This is absurd. I got so furious about this, I called the LaRouche people and gave him a piece of my mind. This is completely outrageous. I told him to take me off their list. This is completely ridiculous. But it's only part of the kind of rubbish. Look, William Colby told us the CIO and everyone of significance in the mass media. And if you read something that's so grossly discrepant that doesn't even pass the smell test like this, you've got to suspect that this may be some of the people he's talking about. And I say here, to my disappointment, Dana Milbeck. Completely untrustworthy, Dana Milbeck. Maureen Dowd, I've admired her forever. I don't know what to make of Maureen Dowd. She just has said something here much more. Seems to me they're seeking to exaggerate here. But this isn't all. Get this. Here's some examples and something you ought to check out if you don't already know. Citizens for Legitimate Government. Al-Qaeda expert re-killed by CIA by Lori Price, 30 July. It's Groundhog Day at the CIA. Abu Kabab al-Masari died in January 2006 and again on Monday. Once again, the mainstream media announced the re-killing of another key Al-Qaeda operative by a CIA-operated piloted drone. These top CIA Al-Qaeda operatives and their subsequent deaths are more bountiful than poppy fields in Afghanistan or oil smuggling routes in Iraq. Here's another one. On the 31st, exclusive to provoke war, Cheney considered proposal to dress up Navy SEALs as Iranians and shoot at them. Speaking at the Campus Progressive Journalism Conference earlier this month, Seymour Hersh, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for The New Yorker, revealed that Bush administration officials held a meeting recently in the vice president's office to discuss ways to provoke war with Iran. Hersh said there were a dozen ideas proffered about how to trigger a war. The one that interested me the most was, why don't we build in our shipyard 4 or 5 boats that look like Iranian PT boats, put Navy SEALs on them with lots of arms, and next time one of our boats goes to the Strait of Hormuz, start a shoot-up. Might cost some lives. It was rejected because you can't have Americans killing Americans. Oh, right. They don't reject it because Americans shouldn't kill Americans. Look what happened on 9/11. These people don't care about killing Americans. Get this. The FBI, here's another headline. The FBI was told to blame anthrax scare on Al-Qaeda by White House officials. This is dated August 2nd. In the immediate aftermath of the 2001 anthrax attacks, White House officials repeatedly pressed FBI Director Robert Mueller to prove it was a second wave assault by Al-Qaeda, but investigators ruled that out. After the October 5, 2001 death from anthrax exposure of Sun photo editor Robert Stevens, Mueller was beaten up during Bush's morning intelligence briefing for not producing proof the killer spores were the handiwork of terrorist mastermind Osama bin Laden. They really wanted to blame it on someone in the Middle East, the retired FBI official told the news. Of course, this was weapons-grade anthrax. It was very rapidly determined to come from Fort Detrick, Maryland. This is not something you could cook up in a cave in Afghanistan. The whole thing's absurd, but we're getting the impression of how much fakery, lies, deceit, and deception we are bombarded with from this administration. Here's another one. Book says White House ordered forgery. This is just August 5th, which, if the calendar is correct, is today. A new book by the author Ron Suskind claims the White House ordered the CIA to forge a backdated handwritten letter from the head of Iraqi intelligence to Saddam Hussein. Suskind writes in The Way of the World to be published Tuesday that the alleged forgery, adamantly denied by the White House, was designed to portray a false link between Hussein's regime and al-Qaeda as a justification for the Iraq war. The author also claims the Bush administration had information from a top Iraqi intelligence official that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, intelligence they received in plenty of time to stop an invasion. This is all done, and we have the reports how the George Tenet went back to the CIA and said, you're not going to like this, but here's what we're being asked to do, and he did it. And he did it. And they did it. The whole thing, smoke, mirrors, lies. Anyone who thinks they wouldn't stoop to special effects and about 9/11 just doesn't understand this administration. This is the Karl Rove playbook of creating your own reality. It's all fraudulent. And get this, this is absolutely stunning. Pentagon study, this is just dated the 31st Thursday. Pentagon study says Bush's war on terror off target. Study calls for fundamental rethinking of U.S. strategy to focus on minimizing overt military action and increasing intelligence collection and partnership with law enforcement agencies around the world. A Pentagon Commission study published Wednesday said the Bush administration's seven-year-old war on terror is off target. The report done by RAND Corporation under a Pentagon Commission said the current strategy for defeating al-Qaeda has not been successful and is unlikely to do better without a shift in emphasis. It said since 2001, al-Qaeda has conducted a greater number of attacks across a larger geographic area than at any time in its history. Now, this, of course, was the Bush had claimed that the Clinton approach, which was a law enforcement and intelligence investigative approach, was not the right approach, and we needed a more muscular foreign policy and to go after them militarily. Here, by the way, any of you who read the New York Times, there's a wonderful book review on August 3rd of a book called The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. You ought to read it. Here are a couple of key parts. Talking about the use of terrorism, torture, for example. This vast regime of pain and terror inflicted in the name of war on terror rests in large part on the untested belief of few high-ranking leaders in Washington that torture is an effective tool for eliciting valuable information. But there is, Mayer pervasively argues, little available evidence that this assumption is true, a great deal suggesting it's false. In fact, it's one of the least effective methods of gathering information and a likely source of false confessions. But you see, I would point out, that's exactly what they wanted. They had to use torture to extract false confessions to support a phony war on terror. There were no true confessions because the terrorists they claimed existed did not. It's truly unbelievable what the United States has descended into. A cesspool of lies and deceit and deception and death. Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, thank you for listening.